Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 131, Interview with the Man, Greg Van Eekhout, and Some Thoughts on Alien Inspiration. This episode is brought to you by Black Halo, the new fantasy novel from Sam Sykes.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell.
This is Moses Sirigar.
And this is Brent Bowen.
Today we are joined by San Diego resident Greg Van Eekhout, a good friend of mine and author of Norse Code, Kid vs. Squid, and The Boy at the End of the World. You know, come to think of it, I think Norse Code might be the first book we gave away on this podcast back in the day. I can't say that with 100% certainty, but I think it was. Anyway, we're going to have him on a little bit. But first, we want to talk about something that I read in the Tor.com newsletter, and I sent it on to Brent and Moses, and we all thought it was really interesting. So we're going to talk about it. And it was a great article from Joan D. Vinge. I don't know about you guys. I've seen Joan's work mostly in used bookstores. Every time I go into a used bookstore, there's usually one or two titles from her there. And I see her because I'm always looking for books from Verner. And, you know, hers are right next to his. But I have to confess, I never really knew who she was or what happened to her. I know I don't see her books in new bookstores. So I didn't know if she had passed away or had stopped writing or what. Well, I learned today, reading the Tor.com newsletter, that she nearly was killed in a car accident about a decade ago. And now her first novel in 10 years has just come out. And it's the novelization of Cowboys and Aliens, which is an awesome movie, by the way. Saw it on my birthday. So it's a great piece, and she talks about losing, well, sort of like losing her will or her ability to write. It's pretty complex. I'll put the link in the show notes so everyone can read it.
It's really a great article. I really would recommend folks to read it. It was very humbling.
Which is why I wanted to talk about it. You know, the car accident was a massive event for her, and here's a little quote from the article at the end there. She says, so saddle up and ride out with the hero of your choice to a place where any day above ground is a good day. Get muddy, get a little choked up, dare to cuss someone out. Watch out, Moses. Grin a lot. Feel pain and loss and saddle sore and thirsty. Most of all, feel happy to be human and simply be alive. Let your imagination lift you up where you belong. The view from there is terrific. So, you know, this got me thinking about creativity, and she talks in the article about everyday courage, you know, overcoming little steps at a time, these events that happen to us, to sort of reclaim your creativity. So, guys, let's talk about creativity and life a little bit. And I kind of want to ask you guys, and you, if this is too personal, you don't have to answer it, but, you know, have there been episodes or events in your life that have stolen your creativity or stolen your inventiveness or your passion even? And how do science fiction and fantasy writers combat that? Or I guess anyone, but I guess we're talking about writers in particular here.
I kind of relate to this a lot just because I feel like before I got into writing, I felt like I was kind of wandering in the desert for quite a while trying to find something that I wanted to feel creative and passionate about. And I even went through a phase where I kind of called it my, you know, quarter life crisis, where I bought this awesome big red shiny keyboard called a Nord Stage, and decided I was going to be a rock star, you know. And like, I didn't get like the red sports car; it was more like the red keyboard, and because I really was looking for something creative to do with my life. And then I didn't follow through with the music thing, and then later I eventually found the writing thing. But I feel like I kind of wandered through the desert for 10 years or something, trying to find something to be creative about, and it's such a humbling process, because all those years I had wanted to find something and it took so long, you know, and I don't know if there's anything I could have done to have sped up that process, because I did everything I could have done, you know. And then one day, as we talked about in the last episode, a friend of mine gets me into playing, you know, fourth edition D&D, and we start playing play by post, and I'm writing stories, and I'm saying, oh, maybe this is what I can do. And that has been fulfilling, knock on wood, for a couple years. But it's just such a, it's so humbling, because you know, you don't know if that muse is going to leave you, you know, in your next breath. And so it's just, it's almost like a, I don't know. I mean, I'm not someone who's been at this long enough to give advice on like how to keep that muse going, but I would assume there are people who would say you just kind of put your butt in the seat and you write, and you make it happen. But I don't know. I'm sure for a lot of people it's not like that, and they just the muse isn't there for a while, and they have to figure that out. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't think that's a crime. I mean, that's one of those things, and I particularly love that line, or the use of saddle sore in here. It's a, you know, the whole approach to life. Sometimes life gets in the way of a lot of things, and it's even reminiscent of some of the conversation I had in one of our most recent shows with Blake Charlton, where it's you hear him talk about life balance and the things he wants to do in life and accomplish in life, and it's not just writing. But he also wants to accomplish medicine, and he believes that those are going to be complementary elements in his life. And I know I've had periods in my life where I've had fits and starts with respect to my writing, and my journey to writing is going to be quite a bit different. And I've talked about this openly, you know, in different blogs and interviews, and I've been asked to do is I view my approach to writing is going to be different than Moses's. It's going to be different from a lot of my classmates from Viable Paradise, just because there are other commitments in my life that I take a lot of joy out of, but I'm also accountable for too, particularly with having, and it was a question that I asked quite a bit of Laura J. Mixon, who is one of my instructors at Viable Paradise. I said, I'm a breadwinner of the family. I have two young children. How am I going to do this? And there was a lot of conversation around patience, both with her and with Patrick Nielsen Hayden. And my son in particular has respiratory issues. So he has really bad, he has allergy induced asthma, and like clockwork, you can count on him getting pneumonia every spring. And that's one of those things where it's like, it's just going to happen. And the mental energy may not be there to write. And as a result, I may not produce 150,000 words in the year, but that's okay. I'm going to produce what I can produce, and I'm going to make sure that I'm finding, to go back to, you know, what Blake Charlton and I talked about, I'm going to make sure I find the joy in it. And if I'm not having fun, then there's a problem, you know, and if I'm not having fun in that regard, it's going to be okay for me to take a break. That's mm-hmm. that, you know, that's kind of the way I view it. And it's okay for each of us to take a bit of a different journey.
Wasn't it Harlan Ellison who said, to suffer for your art is noble, to make your family suffer for your art is to be an asshole? I think that was Ellison who said that. Sounds like him.
It could be. Yeah, it could be.
Well, you must have times, though, Brent, where, I mean, you have that intellectual understanding, but sometimes, especially if you're feeling tired or frustrated, the emotional fabric of your life will take over the intellectual understanding. You know, do you have those moments where it's really frustrating, just wish you could write that book that you really want to write and you can't get it done?
Yeah, I end up changing. I certainly do. I'm a human being and obviously have a range of emotions and dealing with situations that are quite frustrating in that regard. My goals change sometimes to accommodate that. So, as opposed to maybe addressing a novel, I might end up to still kind of dampen that creative urge or address that creative urge, I'll write a short story instead. And I'll find something absurd to, you know, what I thought was beautiful about this piece too, was, you know, Joan's reference to the absurdity of mashing cowboys and aliens. And sometimes that's when I have the most fun with my pieces is I'll just pick a short. And then from a brainstorm standpoint, I'll just say, okay, what's the most absurd combinations of things that I can concoct to create a story. And And again, it's more about adding joy into my, you know, joy into my life. And if it ends up being marketable and somebody loves it, great, yeah. You know? Yeah. So, and that's just where I am personally kind of with my writing. Now, do I have longer term goals from being a professional and being more saleable in that regard? Yeah, sure. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's part of that journey right this moment.
Well, one of the reasons I really like this article is because I saw the movie and I loved it. I thought it was great. And yeah, there's some silliness in it, like the reason why the aliens are here. I wish they could have given even like one sentence deeper explanation. I don't want to give any spoilers. Not that it doesn't really matter. The reason why they're here doesn't really matter. What matters is they're here and what they're doing, you know? Yeah. But the movie just was this great combination of action, adventure, and kind of deep character moments with actually well-rounded characters with character arcs. Mm. And it made me realize, oh my gosh, this is not something you see in a lot of science fiction movies anymore, is it? Where Harrison Ford's character ends the movie in such a different place from where he starts it. Mm. And his performance was just, I thought, really good. Some of the one of his better performances that I've seen in a while. And he's a great actor, so obviously he delivers great performances. But he was so intense and emotionally raw, and it was so perfect juxtaposed to Daniel Craig's kind of cool and calm demeanor, you know? Hmm. So when Joan was talking about that in the article, that, you know, the script sort of helped revive some of her creative desire. That's what I interpreted from the article anyway. I kind of understood that because I remember leaving that movie thinking, I want to write something like that.
That's beautiful. Yeah, she talked about just, you know, when she had this accident, she lost her sense of who she was. She knew herself as a writer. And so one day she's driving down the street and gets hit by a massive truck with this, you know, head injury. And all of a sudden she's not who she used to be anymore. It's hard for her to do that. And man, that's just one of those things that just you can't really make too much sense out of it. But how beautiful that she came, you know, came back to it. And she clearly writes well. I mean, just that article that we read, I mean, it was like she hit on a lot of levels in that little blog post. And so she's definitely firing on all cylinders right now, which is a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, it was really a treatise on perseverance. I mean, you talk about that being a trait of a writer. At her core, she's a writer just by demonstrating the perseverance. Even almost forget all of the layers that were addressed in the post. Just the perseverance displayed in her journey, I think, was impressive, and how she put that out in the post.
That's similar to what I was going to say a little bit about my process with, you know, I've only written one novel, took me 2 years, but the reason I got it done had a lot to do with perseverance, discipline, willpower. You know, I mean, I started off doing Michael Stackpole's 21 Days to a Novel, where every day you do a little exercise related to your novel. And I said, I'm going to do this every single day. And then I got done and I said, I'm going to write every single day. And I did. I wrote every day for a while. And then I did NaNoWriMo. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to do this. And that, for, you know, I mean, I had some highs and low moments throughout those 2 years. Sometimes I was real productive, sometimes not as much. But basically, that's what carried me through a couple of years, was just perseverance, discipline, willpower, getting it done. And what's humbling about that is that that doesn't always work in life. Sometimes that works, and sometimes life comes up and doesn't let you do it, or sometimes the muse isn't there for you, the passion isn't there for you. And so I don't know what it's like to run into that yet with my writing. And, you know, like any writer, if I stick at it, I'm sure I'll run into that. But in the meantime, you know, what has worked for me is just setting clear goals, making it a daily practice, getting it done, doing what you have to do to inspire yourself. For me, I listen to loud music and music that really inspires me, and I get into it and have fun and just keep banging away. But you know, that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I don't know.
And now Moses Sirigar and the Thirds.
You guys should check out my new playlist for my next book. Did you guys see this?
I made a suggestion, but you shot it down.
It's true. But But no, because it's like a very particular thing, you know. So it is on my blog where I put it out and I said, hey, you know, guys, I need music to write to for my next book. And I ended up collecting 20 songs. I had to turn down most songs I got.
Yeah.
And I collected 20 songs that just, to me, just, you know, these are amazing songs. Music, I don't think I'd heard of any of it before. Maybe one song out of the 20. I don't think it was that. So like, I'm ready to write my next book because I've got a music playlist that is going to just rock my world, man. Some of these songs just are amazing. I listened to one of them. And I got this just download of information about the characters in the next book and things that are going to happen just from that one song, just unlocking some part of my brain or something. Hmm. So that works for me. It's like the music thing is really huge for me.
Yeah, I was going to tease you and say how many of the 20 were Decemberist songs, but
none of them. I did get one submission for a Decemberist song, and I think I turned it down.
Okay. Well, was that my Collective Soul December?
Was it what now?
The song I recommended was called December, but it was from Collective Soul. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's like a cool song, but you know, I get in a certain mood, you know, and it just wouldn't have worked for my mood I need to be in.
Well, did you guys notice how we got through that whole segment? I never had to talk about myself. Well, we're out of time on this one.
So Sean, tell us about, you know, what happened to you.
Oh, okay, we're gonna take a break and we'll be right back with Well, yeah, okay, we actually are running out of time. I'll make this quick. When I got out of college, well, I decided pretty early on in life I thought I wanted to be a writer. I started trying to write my first novel when I was 13 in a red three-ring binder. I wrote about 40 pages of a Star Trek The Next Generation piece of crap. But it was awesome. It had a saucer separation in it. Okay. And the Picard maneuver. Only true Star Trek fans know about the Picard maneuver because it's really lame. So luckily they only talked about it in one episode. you know, but I never really did much until I took a short story class in college. Then when I graduated college, got a job, sort of. And so I started trying it out, and I wrote 3 novels in about 2 years, and I was definitely getting better. And then we had a kid. Now, what happened when my son was born is I stayed home because I was making less money, and my wife was offered a promotion at the same time. So she only took a few weeks off, and she went straight back to work. That huge life-shattering – having a kid is kind of life-shattering, actually. I don't mean to in a negative way, but it changes everything about your life.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of threw me out of writing, and – we learned very quickly that we weren't very good budgeters, and we didn't really know how much money was coming in and how much is going out. And then we were facing foreclosure, and it looked like we were going to lose our home. We were able to, you know, praise God, short sale it. So we didn't go through that. This is early on in the short sale process too. It wasn't like now where they're common, but we were able to get out of that. And then I took on a job delivering pizza, you know, and then we moved to where we are now, to Northern California. So in that entire process, you know, I started studying for real estate exam, became a real estate agent. Writing went away. I didn't feel like I had the time for it, and I didn't have the heart for it. I was just too stressed out and frustrated with life. And that kind of brings us to the present. I haven't done much writing in the last 4 years, maybe like a couple short stories a year. So, you know, this year I really tried to make a change on that. I've written, I think, about 70,000 words this year. But I've done very little lately because now I'm career retooling again. So I have a big exam I have to take again. And I'm behind in my studying because I was choosing to write in the morning because you have to do it, right? So
yeah.
Now I'm not writing again. And it's very frustrating. And I sometimes wonder, will I ever be able to even just have a day job, you know, like have the job and write one page in the morning or one page at night, you know? But when you're working a job and career training and I'm in charge of 2 kids for half the day, the whole day can go by pretty quick. Yeah. And you don't know where it went, you know. So I kind of connected a bit with her piece. I haven't had a car accident, but I have felt like life has piled on me a little bit the last couple of years. And a lot of good things have come out of that. I've discovered a lot of things about myself that I would not have discovered without it. So I think over the course of my life, I will be a better person because of all this. In the short term, you know, I haven't accomplished the things I hoped I would have accomplished. But I have to say, Moses, that the changes in publishing and seeing what you're doing and the passion with which you're putting your book out there has been very beneficial for me. Because one of the things that kind of held me back too was, well, what are the odds that, you know, getting published is so difficult? And yes, it can happen. But it was something that to deter me on top of everything else.
Right.
And now I know, well, I can do a good job and put it out there myself. And at least then I know someone would be reading it and hopefully like it, you know. So that's part of what has encouraged me to try much harder this year. And that's why I have actually been able to get some words down.
Nice.
So, I mean, I hope I can do more, but right now I'm not writing. It's every moment I get, I'm that's not doing the podcast. Some say would say, well, Sean, stop podcasting.
We hope not, but that's how I looked at the market too, is that if I write something, I know, even if I had wanted to get a traditional publisher, as I did originally in the beginning, I did, of course, then I figured out, oh, well, there's this other opportunity. But no matter what, you can get it out to some people, you know?
Right.
So that's what's great about it. I mean, you can still pursue a traditional goal with publishing, but there is a fallback, which is awesome, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's cool. That's really good.
So now that we've all exposed our souls on the podcast today, you know, if any of you have ideas on creativity, how to persevere through the, I put in my notes here, trials. Where's that? How do you spell trials? Wait a minute. Anyway, how to get through the trials and
like
tribulations.
Happy trails? Are you staying with the cowboy metaphor? What are you doing here?
Yeah. I had that on my brain, apparently. No, but if you have ideas on this subject or experiences you'd like to share, please give us a call, 619-75-AISFP, and we'd love to share it. You can keep it anonymous, too, if you don't want to. Well, it is going to be anonymous. You can just give us your first name or fake name. We'll never know. Well, guys, this is a big topic. Do you have any final thoughts before we move on with the interview?
It's a huge topic, so it's hard to sum it up, you know. But that's why creativity is just, you know, you can't really grab it. You know, you try to grab it and it slips through your fingers, and you just got to do your best and pray to whatever you pray to if you're into that, and just hope that some kind of muse, you know, lights your fire.
Do your best and forget the rest, right?
Yeah. Joelle, just get, you know, get the butt in the chair, get into the act of writing, and then, you know, make sure that you're finding joy in it. That's all I can say.
All right, let's take a break. We'll be back with Greg in just a second. This episode is brought to you by Black Halo, the sequel to the breakout novel Tome of the Endergates by Sam Sykes. The Tome of the Endergates has been recovered, and the gates of hell remain closed. Lenk and his five companions set sail to bring the accursed relic away from the demonic reach of the Kraken Queen. But after weeks at sea, tensions amidst the adventurers are rising. Their troubles are only beginning when their ship crashes upon an island made of bones left behind from a war long dead. Don't miss book two of The Aeon's Gate, from the author praised by John Scalzi, who said, "I do not wish Sam Sykes dead." I mean, come on, you can't ask for a better endorsement than that. Black Halo by Sam Sykes, available at bookstores everywhere and online. To learn more, please visit our website and click on the image for Black Halo. So with the 5-year anniversary of the podcast coming up, I really wanted to have some of my favorite guests from the past come on the show, and just some of my favorite people in this business. So Greg Van Eekhout was at the top of my list, and luckily when I hit him up on Twitter about it, he wasn't like, "What, you suck?" So so thanks for that, buddy. I appreciate it.
You know, I try to make you feel good about yourself.
I need that. Don't we all need that, especially creative people?
I don't think we need it any more than anybody else. I just think we have societal permission to be needy about it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll buy that. All right. Well, Greg is the author of Norse Code, and last time he was on the show, that was the topic of our discussion. He's also the author of Kid versus Squid and the new middle grade novel, right? Middle grade boy at the end of the world. Is that how you would describe it, middle grade?
It's definitely middle grade. I think it says so right on the cover somewhere.
Oh, it does. Okay. Well, I got a copy of it.
It might. I don't know.
Okay, let's see here. This is an uncorrected advanced proof. All right. Well, anyway, it looks cool.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, I'm glad your publisher sent me a copy. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a couple of years. But another one of the reasons I wanted to have Greg on is because, Greg, I don't know if you really know this, but you were really one of the first professional writers to sort of, like, form a friendship with me when I was living in San Diego and actually,
really?
Like, go out of your way to hang out with me a little bit, whether it's, you know, like, meeting at Starbucks or having pizza or, you know, whatever we did. So I've never told you this before, but, you know, I always appreciated that. You kind of made me feel more comfortable just being myself and being trying to get into this business and in this community. So I owe you a debt of gratitude. So thank you.
Yeah, there's no debt, man. I was like a recent transplant to San Diego, and I was just like looking for people to hang out with and talk to. And, you know, we had the commonality of the sci-fi geekdom and the writing and stuff like that. So it was just cool to hang out. I miss you, Sean.
And you looked at some of my early short stories, which weren't that great either. So,
No. It's you know, there's like this weird sort of perception that there's a big difference between, like, you know, the pros and the semi pros and the amateurs, and it's really, you know, there are people writing and there are people hopefully getting better all the time, not just, you know, people who haven't published widely yet, but, you know, the professionals too. I don't really think there's that big a difference between, you know, people like that.
Yeah. Well, obviously we're going to talk about your new book. I have some questions on that for you. But first, you know, Comic-Con 2011 just ended a few days in your rear view mirror, and I know you were there. Unfortunately, yeah. I wasn't there to see you this year. But, you know, tell us a little bit about what you did, who you met, you know, some of the highlights.
Well, let's see. You know, I mean, this is my philosophy of Comic-Con. And if people aren't, I mean, I think everybody's heard of it and they have an idea. But it's 125,000 people that go to this thing. So, you know, that's the size of like a decent sized city, all convened downtown San Diego in a convention center. And everybody there is passionate about something, whether it's movies or books or comics or, you know, costuming or gaming or whatever. So I think the most valuable thing I get out of Comic-Con is just like this great, huge energy. It's just everybody there loves something and they're not shy about it. And it's just, you know, when I'm tired and cynical and feel weary, it's good to go to Comic-Con, as terrifying as that number of people is, and get energized. I don't go to like see any of the big programming because I don't want to wait in like a line that goes all the way back to like, you know, SeaWorld or
right.
or you know, into Mexico in some cases, and then get like, you know, right to the door and then not get in because the room is full. So I wandered into some panels. I saw David Peterson, the guy that does Mouse Guard. I saw him draw mice, and I, you know, he demonstrated his processes and techniques. I found it really interesting. I went to a panel on diversity in media, you know, that was done by the race bending people, the people that were politically active during the making of the Last Airbender movie. Walking the dealer's room. Oh, you know, it's really cool. Like you walk across the street. This is a Comic-Con thing. You walk across the street and you just kind of look to your right. And it's the guy that played the original Boomer in Battlestar Galactica just walking across the street with you. It's like, oh yeah, it's just one time I was there last year and I just kind of looked to my right and, you know, William Shatner is just walking down some stairs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just pretty much, if you dig media, nerdy stuff of any kind, it really is like this like huge celebration mecca. You know, and I talked to some, I'm interested in doing comics. I don't have any professional experience doing that. So I just talked to some writers, some people I know and some people they know, just to sort of put a foot in that door and just kind of figure out what that's all about, how it works, how you break in, what the money is like. So professionally, you know, there's maybe some benefits down the road. But yeah, my attitude, I also did a panel. I did a panel on middle grade writing with, I was on a table with a bunch of people I probably don't deserve to be with. The thing about Comic-Con is everybody talks about how Hollywood has taken it over and how the comics stuff is no longer important. And, you know, I mean, books are probably the like one of the least important programming items. But Comic-Con is so huge that a panel on books, just like on a Sunday when things are dwindling down, we still got like, I don't know, 200 or 300 people in that audience. You know, it's
right.
Just everything is so big that no matter what you do, there's a big audience for it. So that was kind of cool.
There is no small draw at Comic-Con. It's all large.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of like the most like obscure fandom thing I can think of, like, you know, filking about, you know, fan fiction about clams, and it's probably like fills like a 4,000 person hall or something like that.
Clam filking.
Oh, that's the next big thing, Sean. I'm really hoping to dip my toe and break into the field of clam filking.
Well, you know, you do have talent. I can see it.
You haven't even heard me sing yet. Oh my God, let me tell you.
Oh, we'll do a separate take. We'll put it at the end of the episode.
I think I deserve a separate episode, yeah. Really, but okay.
Some of the, I remember some of my encounters, like you said, at Comic-Con, you're going to have encounters, even if mm-hmm. you're just walking around. Mine was, I'm just standing in the hallway, and next thing I know, Ben Browder standing next to me.
Holy.
And it was an empty hallway. and he I shook his hand, and he gave me this smile, and the smile was just like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. it's good. It's a good, this is a good moment for you, isn't it?
It is. And I made it clear that, yeah, it was a good moment for me. And then, yeah, of course, cool. 2 years after that, I got to interview him there. So that was even cooler. And he's a cool guy.
Yeah, you've done a lot of interviews with, you know, the celebrities at Comic-Con. And they're there to like do PR and stuff like that. So they are accessible.
Yeah, they are. And I've always focused on kind of the Stargate stuff. That's what I'm into. But every year I've gone, I've been able to do some interviews with Stargate folk. And, you know, so Comic-Con, their media people are really good to everyone. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter how big mm-hmm. or how small your venue is, at least from my perspective. Everyone gets treated equally. Everyone gets a shot because obviously, you know, I'm standing there next to like Fox and Sci-Fi Magazine, interviewing these actors. And no one looks at me any differently just because I have a, you know, smaller podcast. I'm one of them, you know, and it was a great experience. Hopefully I can go next year.
I think they understand the, not to use like gross, unctuous marketing terms, but they understand like one-to-one marketing. You know, they understand that there is just as much value in talking to like a local TV station as there is in talking to like a guy with a podcast. Probably actually there's more value in talking to a guy with a podcast. So yeah, they seem pretty intelligent about it.
Okay. Let's talk about the boy at the end of the world. Can you start us off a little bit by telling us, well, maybe a little bit about the world in which young Fisher finds himself.
Well, you know, going back, the way the story started is I seem to have like this weird thing about writing broken robot characters. They've shown up in a number of my short stories. And so at a certain point, I realized I had to come up with another idea for another middle grade book. And I thought, like, you know, kid in a broken robot. And then I thought, like, well, you know, that's two characters. We need a third character because two characters is like a buddy. You know, a buddy film,
right?
Whereas three characters is a quest. And I'm like, eh, I'm more quest kind of guy than a buddy film kind of guy. So I threw in a mammoth, you know, just kind of arbitrarily. Also, mammoths are really cool. And so when I was talking to my editor, this is actually before I sold Kid versus Squid. Kid versus Squid and Boy at the End of the World are two books on a two-book contract that I signed with Bloomsbury. And before I actually signed Kid versus Squid, my editor just wanted to have a conversation with me just to see if I was, you know, like a raving lunatic, if we could work together, if I was, you know, drunk. So I sobered up really quick. And then, you know, she asked me, like, what else I had after Kid versus Squid. And I said, you know, I got this thing, this kid, this broken robot, this mammoth, full stop. She turns out she likes elephants. She likes elephants a lot. So she's like, I want that book. So it's like, okay, now I got to figure out what the story is. So, you know, I was thinking like the kind of story that you would have a broken robot and a mammoth and a boy, and it's a quest. I instinctively felt it's post-apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess that's just the way, like, you know, my mind went. It probably could have been like cyberpunk or something else for all I know. So post-apocalyptic.
Could have been a bad remake of The Wizard of Oz.
You know, that's the danger because like that is the Wizard of Oz structure, you know?
Right.
And honestly, I think except for the flying monkeys, I've never really dug that movie. You know, it's not a part of my beloved childhood. It's not really a part of my pantheon. The flying monkeys, you know, are kind of cool though. So, you know, post-apocalyptic. And I remember as a kid growing up, I really dug the Planet of the Apes movies. So I thought, you know, far enough into the future that things are really, really different, you know? And at the time, I remember on the History Channel, before they were just showing like all this stuff about guys that run pawn shops, which seems to be all that's on now.
Right.
They had, you know, it's like, come on. Yeah, it's a very valuable tenor saxophone. I'm sure that's Elvis's. So I'm really. So they had this show, and I can't remember the title, but it was like basically like what happens to stuff as time goes on. It was, oh, it was like without people or no more humans or something like that. And it was just, they'd say like, okay, this is, you know, New York. And people are gone, and they would just trace the decay of New York over the millennia to the point that it's just like, it's not recognizable. It's just a jungle. Mm. And kind of the idea of the world sort of like being reclaimed by nature, that kind of appealed to me. So it's North America, because this is where I live. So I decided to set it in North America. It is far future. I don't specify how far, but it's far enough that the forests and the jungles and the woods and just, you know, lawn grass, kudzu, whatever, is sort of reclaimed almost everything. I also added in the idea of unintended consequences. You know, I mean, as we face global warming, we might come up with technological solutions, which might actually solve global warming problem, but it might create additional problems. So in my view of the far past in this world, people have tried to deal with climate and catastrophe, but with unintended consequences. There have been other things that have happened. Hmm. They've maybe tried genetic engineering to save perishing species. And maybe those animals, maybe some of them survived, you know, like whatever environmental degradation and war and disease and time have changed this world. And they are much changed too. So those are kind of the basic tenets. The world is very far in the future. Things have changed. Some of it is natural process, but it is complicated and weirded out by human intervention. And what that allowed me to do is that allowed me to say like, well, you know what, in 10,000 years, we're probably not going to have parrots the size of elephants. That's unlikely to evolve. But if we throw in like that X factor, the genetic engineering, then I gave myself permission to say like, if I want elephant-sized parrots, I can have elephant-sized parrots. Mm. It's speculative fiction, but it is not completely divorced from science. On the other hand, it's not a real detailed study in what the world will be like in 10,000 years or 100,000 years.
So let me jump in and ask you this then. With all these ideas you have about the backstory of the book, how many of those details come into play in the novel itself, and how much of it were things that you just had to understand and you had to know so you could make the world feel real?
Yeah, it's a good point, because it's more important almost to know that stuff in your head that doesn't make it on the page. The idea is that the world exists beyond the margins of the page. And that's the stuff that you can't actually detect in black and white, because it's not actually there in like letters and symbols on paper, but it exists. You can feel it. It's in the texture. It's reflected in every word that is on the page. In this case, a lot of the stuff actually is on the page, because it being middle grade, I thought it would be interesting if my character had to ask questions about what happened and figure out what happened. And the robot character has some knowledge that the protagonist, his name is Fisher, does not have. In fact, Fisher knows almost nothing, because he's like this sort of genetically engineered blank slate living in the survival pod with a bunch of other, you know, people in this bunker underground. And when that survival bunker is attacked, the robot, who is a custodial robot, downloads a personality into him, because that's the idea. At a certain point, the Earth is recovered. We can have a population again. We download stored personalities into all these people. So we have all the societal roles we need to carry on. And he just... robot punches, like, you know, his finger actually slips and he gives him the wrong one. He gives him a fisher profile. You know, he can fish when he should have given him like the ability to hunt or to like build things, you know, something a little that would have made his life a little easier. Right. So Fisher doesn't know a lot, and the robot does actually function to sort of inform him on backstory and what's happened. And then a lot of it he learns through the process of discovery. So, you know, I wanted him to be able to have a world, a character who is learning about the world at the same time that the reader is.
It seems to me that middle grade novels almost have to, at least to some degree, be a story about discovery, because when you're a middle-aged kid, man, your whole life is discovery.
Yeah, that's a thing. I mean, a lot of people say that's about YA, but I think it's even more true of middle grade, is that everything you're experiencing emotions and situations and having thoughts that are as complicated as an adult and maybe as sophisticated as an adult, but you're experiencing it for the first time. You don't have, you know, like, well, this is the fifth time this has happened to me, and now I have, you know, the experience to sort of, you know, react as an experienced person. Right. It's happened to you for the first time. So the impact of those moments is greater. And that's actually the fun of writing for the middle grade audience, is that it's not only that you have permission to have the character really be affected by everything that happens. But that's actually what makes middle grade fiction fun and interesting as an adult writer and as an adult reader of middle grade fiction. It makes it interesting for me to create and consume.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationships among the characters?
I'd rather not.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
I should know. Don't give you a choice from now on.
Greg, do this. Yeah, well, we start off with the character Fisher. First chapter is his. He's all alone. He's very isolated. The next chapters, he meets this robot, Click, who is sort of – Click is programmed to help Fisher survive. He's programmed to help humanity survive. In an ideal situation, the entire sort of colony would have been awoken, and he's just there to assist them. In helping Fisher survive, though, that's a conflict that Fisher is the only person on Earth, because Fisher has to basically risk to survive. He has to do everything. He has to risk to get food. He has to risk to find out where he is. Ultimately, Fisher makes the decision he's going to set out and see if, in fact, he is the last human alive or if there are any others. And that puts him at greater risk and jeopardy. And the robot Click really doesn't want him to do that. That's counter to Click's programming. So you've got that kind of conflict. And it gives you know, opportunity to have sort of like a comedic banter back and forth, these two characters at odds. The mammoth, again, because I wanted a third character, he's a cloned pygmy mammoth who's, you know, wandering about in the woods. And, you know, I knew I wanted him in the book, but I really didn't have a role for him for the longest time through actually most of the first draft. There were some scenes like I actually forgot he was there and had to go back and add him back in. Mm. And then I decided if you have an animal, you can just give him a couple of little moments, a few personality traits. So his personality trait is, it's never stated explicitly in the book, but for whatever reason, he has a bit of a fixation on the robot. He's always giving him sticks and rocks just as gifts that the robot doesn't need. And also the thing about the mammoth is he knows where he's going. You know, elephants have that thing that they have at least some kind of analog to our memory that they know where they're going, even like across generations. So it makes sense for Fisher to say, like, if I link myself up with this mammoth and if he's going in the general direction I think we should be going, then I'm going to go with him. But at first, it's not like that. The mammoth's name is Protein. That's what Fisher names him. Because Fisher's first impression is there's a lot of meat on this mammoth. And if I kill it and eat it, my belly's full for a long time. So I kind of like the idea of him having an animal companion who at any moment, you're not sure, is our hero going to kill like one of, you know, is he going to kill the cute character in the book and eat him? So, so yeah, you know, that kind of was a fun sort of tension to write.
That'd be really twisted if that.
Oh, so at times it was just like, and on chapter 4, you know, Protein is roasted on a spit.
Oh, okay. Moving on.
But I want to make sure that people know he does not get roasted on a spit.
I assume not. I mean, if this was an adult novel, hey, maybe it does happen. But I assume because of the age group that didn't happen.
Yeah. Spoilers. I don't roast the mammoth on a spit.
So you've said you have written some stories about robots, and of course, probably everyone listening to the show has read or at least seen movies about robots. Mm-hmm. So I have a question about you for you on this. Doing this, and you're making decisions about technological function and limitations, intelligence, personality, and emotions. You know, how human-like do you make the robot? You know, how do you approach creating a robotic character?
Yeah, well, I think it makes... You know, sometimes it might just make sense to have a robot who is essentially just like, you know, a forklift or whatever, a smart forklift. But in this case, this robot has to autonomously run this survival bunker, deal with situations that cannot be predicted. And then once, which, you know, unfortunately, because disaster has befallen the survival bunker and this doesn't go as planned, but the idea is once the Earth is inhabitable again by humans, he's going to wake the humans and he's going to assist them in building a society. So to me, it made sense to give him a very human-like artificial intelligence. Hmm. You know, I'm playing right on the edge of whether he has emotions or whether he has behaviors that are close enough to emotions that why shouldn't we just call them emotions? Okay. You know, because quite frankly, they're probably human beings that have less emotional reaction just because they're messed up inside, you know? We still call them human. We still think they have emotion. So, you know, and one of the great, I think, characters to argue this debate of humanity is, of course, Data. I was so angry when they gave him the emotion chip, you know, because it kind of, it just eradicated the question of whether he had emotions or not. His programming was so sophisticated that his reactions were naive, but they were very similar to the reactions a human might have, you know, expressed in different ways, or maybe he didn't actually understand how these programming impulses, these inputs needed to be expressed. But he was so close to being human. As far as I'm concerned, the great poignance of him is like he's human, but he doesn't know it. And I thought that was kind of obvious to everybody, but I guess not, because they gave him the emotion chip and messed that up. So sorry to go on a little Star Trek rant, but it's been building up inside.
Hey, we love Star Trek rants. We just had one a couple episodes ago. So.
Oh, yeah? Awesome.
Actually, what I like, though, in that final TNG movie where they killed Data, but of course they have the Beta there. I think his name was Beta. So Data sort of lived on, like, they give you the obvious hint that Data's memories are still somehow alive in there. But I thought, you know what, that would have been a great character exploration if they could have made another film and shown us what happens with Beta, you know, but unfortunately that's never going to happen.
You know, none of this sounds familiar. I might have bailed on the franchise by the time that last one came out.
Oh, no? Okay, the last movie, oh, crap, what was it called? Nemesis?
Star Trek Enough?
Star Trek Enough.
I thought I saw Nemesis.
Yeah, Nemesis, the one with Picard's clone.
Who was kind of like a...
Romulans.
Okay, here's how much I bailed on the franchise. I've seen that movie and promptly forgot about it. Is that the one with the dune buggy? Do they have a dune buggy?
Yeah, they did.
Okay, the dune buggy one. Got it. And they sing. Data sings in the while he's crashing a shuttle or something like that.
Well, he sings while crashing the shuttle in... Oh, yeah. Is it that one? Oh, crud.
God, I don't know.
Crud.
my robot don't get no emotion chip. He don't sing any. There's no dune buggies.
Oh, anyway,
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, okay, good. No dune buggies. That did kind of stick out like a sore thumb in the Star Trek mythos. All of a sudden, they have rubber wheels.
It's about the only thing I remember from that movie, so it must have stuck out.
Okay, so kind of changing the subject on you here. When we last had you on, we were talking about Norse code. Mm-hmm. And now your last two books have been for middle readers. So why the change in approach there, change in audience?
My assumption before Norse Code was even released was that it was going to be a failure, because that's just how I think, and that I was going to have to change my name right under a pseudonym and switch genres. So before the book Norse Code came out, I had planned my reboot.
Wow.
I know, right? So, you know, it worked out okay, because, you know, Norse Code, I'm not, you know, saying it was a blockbuster, but, you know, it's still in print, it's still selling, and, you know, there are, I understand, in this country still some bookstores, and many of them still stock Norse Code. So I guess I didn't have to quite reboot yet, but it turns out, as I sort of had a hunch that I would really enjoy writing middle grade. So I'm really happy that I took time away from, you know, the adult stuff and wrote these two books. And I'm kind of looking forward to being done with my next contract so that I can, or, you know, at least the next book, so that I can figure out some time to write another middle grade book. Because it turns out I actually feel almost at my most natural, it turns out, when I'm writing middle grade. Like, it feels, at least for now, at this part of my career, like, you know, this is kind of where I want to be. This is kind of what feels right for me. And it's, you know, it's hard to say why, you know, like, why do people, some people like writing some genres or some subgenres over others. I don't know what it is that middle grade makes me just feel like, you know, in an sort of examined way, just natural. Whereas writing other stuff, it feels like it's rewarding, you know, and it's stimulating, but it feels like something I'm sort of striving for, to like be the kind of writer that can do that kind of stuff well. Middle grade is great. It's like, you know, the audience, it's a time that I remember really, even I have more fresh memories of being that age. And I guess for your audience, we should just kind of maybe define it. But middle grade is generally like 8 to 12. Sometimes they'll bump it up to about 13, maybe even 14. But it's generally like that sort of like tween or very early teen stage versus YA, which is older. And I think middle grade is a time when the interests you have that might last you an entire lifetime, like, you know, reading or art or music or team sports or whatever, when those interests first kind of emerge. And I remember that period of my life of viewing everything with a great deal of enthusiasm, right, without the angst of being a teen. it's just a very, I think it's just a very powerful period. And I sense that when I meet middle grade readers, that they are in a very interesting, powerful period of their lives. So it's just kind of a fun age to write for. And it's kind of just fun to work with that kind of material for me.
Do you almost feel like you're tying into this sort of age of innocence where there's, you don't have cynicism coloring everything that you're looking at? I mean, I'm not trying to define how you see things, but I know obviously when I look back at myself as a kid, you know, I didn't have any cynicism about anything. And now I have cynicism about everything.
Yeah, right. No, that's the great tragedy of growing up. You get to drink beer and you get to drive and you get cynicism. you know, I don't really recall that being like a total age of innocence for me. You know, I mean, clearly like I was less cynical than I became as an adolescent, which was like sort of probably the height of my cynicism. I've become, I think, a little more innocent and optimistic since. But, you know, I mean, I don't recall a time where I didn't think that adults didn't know what they were talking about and didn't know what they were doing, where I wasn't scoffing at their incompetence. Man, when I was 11 years old, I broke my arm on the playground during PE. I limped over in agony to the PE teacher and said, Could I go to the nurse's office? She takes my arm. She shakes it around a bit and says, nah, you're all right. So I had to lie, probably the first lie I ever told a teacher, and say like, well, I'm just going to get a drink of water then and I'll be right back. And I, you know, crawled to the nurse's office. Now, it wasn't even the first time that I realized that adults really don't necessarily know what's going on. So I don't really recall that as a time of innocence. It is maybe a time where your enthusiasms are not anything you have to be embarrassed about. You know, I mean, it's like, it's almost a crime for adults to be overly sincere or overly earnest, you know, in middle grade. That's a time where it's like, well, that's what you're supposed to be. You know, it's I think there's a difference between innocence and just, you know, full like hearted enthusiasm for the stuff you love.
Okay. Well, actually you just came from Comic-Con. So you saw 125,000 adolescents walking around middle graders walking around in adult bodies.
Pretty much, essentially, yeah.
Which is why we love it, right?
That is what we go there for.
So I know you're working on a new project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's the working title. I don't think this is a good title for a book because it's got a word that's made up, and I don't think made up words are necessarily great titles. It's called The Osteomancer's Son. It was based on a short story that was in Asimov's, I think, like 2006.
I've read that story.
Okay.
That's based on, yeah.
And the idea is that we're in a sort of an alternate version of Los Angeles in which magic works. And the main mechanism is through consuming the remains of magical creatures. You know, the heart of the story, the geographic heart of the story is the La Brea Tar Pits. And I grew up in LA, so that was always sort of like on my, like, you know, my radar. It was just like a really weird, interesting, awesome place, the La Brea Tar Pits. And so I thought like, well, instead of just mammoths and just like saber-toothed cats, what if you also could dig like, you know, griffins, you know, or the American version of a griffin, or like, you know, the Colombian dragon, their remains out of those pits? There would be magic invested in those bones, you know, and you could grind that magic. You could, you know, distill it down into oils and powders. You could smoke it. You could snort it. You could eat it. So the magicians get their powers from consuming this stuff. That's the basic engine driving Los Angeles. So I went one step further than that. Like if you get magic by consuming magic, what happens to the person who consumes magic? So if you're a powerful wizard because you've consumed a lot of magic, you've got all this magic in your bones, and now people are going to be after you basically to kill you and get that magic out of you. And that sort of tied into all these themes of exploitation and using people. There's a term that we use all the time in business, and I'm sure it's fine, but I hate the term human resources. You know, it's like, I'm not a human resource. I'm actually a human being. So, you know, so why can't we just call them personnel anymore? Why don't we have personnel offices? Why does it have to be human resources? Anyway, you know, and, you know, all the love to the human resources managers in the world. I know you have hard jobs and, you know, you do great, but I don't like the title of your job. So this idea that people are used as resources seems to me like just sort of broadly an interesting theme. And the idea of, you know, magicians running around Los Angeles, they're the ones causing the earthquakes and the mudslides and the wildfires. Mm. And it ties into all of California. And really, like, you know, I'm thinking like the entire world view is probably like there's nothing endemic to Los Angeles that magic would only exist there. It would exist everywhere in some form because there's magical creatures all over the world, right?
Right.
Or at least their remains, their fossils. You know, there's probably like, you know, griffins on the frozen steppes and like, you know, the tundra of Siberia, you know, because we find mammoths like that. And so this whole worldview, but the character is centered in Los Angeles. And he's a guy whose father was a powerful magician. And when he was 12 years old, the head of Los Angeles basically tagged him and said, we're going to kill this guy. We're going to eat him and eat his son too, because his son's got magic in him and the son gets away. So he's been living in hiding all these years. And he's kind of gotten by, instead of as a magician, because he doesn't want to necessarily advertise, hey, I'm a wizard, come and get me. He's been getting by as a thief. And then he finds out that the hierarch, the head of Los Angeles who killed his father, is storing a lot of magic that includes his father's remains in his, you know, his stronghold. So it's got this heist element where now our thief guy, our hero, is trying to get those remains back, not just for revenge or anything like that, but as long as the hierarch has his father's remains, he also has elements of the wizard's son, this kid, this thief. So
that sounds pretty cool.
I think that's all right.
I think it sounds cool. That's through Tor. And when is that going to come out?
Hard to say. I would be surprised if it actually got out in 2012, because I'm turning it in the first book. It's a trilogy. I'm turning the first book in at the end of 2011. So I would think maybe late 2012, but probably by early 2013.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to have you back on again for that one.
Oh, thanks, Sean.
Because that sounds and make sure I get a copy of that too. Even Tor's pretty good at that. Even though they sent me a list, a checklist of like all their catalog for the next 6 months, and they're like, okay, check off the ones you want, and we'll send it to you. So I did, but I haven't gotten any of them yet. So.
the heart's in the right place, man. Heart's in the right place. I'll make sure you get a copy.
Okay, good, good. Okay, we just have a quick minute left here, but I need to ask you this: your book is coming out, or it has been out for a few weeks now. Mm-hmm. Right when Borders decides that they can't survive any longer. In just a quick minute here, can you tell us your thoughts on that, how you think that it might affect you, how it might affect other authors, just your kind of your general impressions?
It doesn't affect this The Boy at the End of the World specifically. Borders has been swirling down the toilet for several months and ordering fewer and fewer books. And unfortunately, I was really upset about this. They didn't order Boy at the End of the World. You could not buy it in a Borders store.
Okay.
So even though, you know, they've stocked the other books, this one, no. So it doesn't really affect me in terms of this book, but it's a horrible thing. I mean, that's 600 stores across the country that no longer sell books. That means a lot of communities don't have a bookstore. That means publishers and authors have 600 fewer outlets for their books. That's a lot of places that aren't selling their books. So it's just bad. And I, you know, in the long run, it is probably, I think, a good thing, because it means that bookstores are going to have to operate smarter. Borders did not operate that intelligently recently, I don't think. And hopefully it'll open up some opportunities for independent bookstores. But, you know, it takes capital and it takes time and it takes work to open a new bookstore. So it's going to be a while till we see recovery from that. So it's kind of catastrophic, I think, for bookselling, you know, and it's probably good for Amazon. But having, you know, all the publishing power just in a few places, I don't think benefits anybody, even if you're one of those big places. You know, I think we need a diverse, healthy, varied way to buy books, and we just lost one of the major ones.
And it, you know, we're looking at changes in the business model too, whereas publishers used to say, okay, we have to sell this to Barnes and Noble and Borders. Well, now there's just BN. And when you see, you know, ebooks increasing by, you know, double and triple every year, I think that we're going to see a change to more direct to consumer marketing rather than direct to book buyer at Barnes and Noble marketing. But, you know, time will tell. In the long run, my feeling is things will work out, but in the next few years, it's going to make the waters pretty choppy.
Yeah, I think things will work out. This is kind of a major blow, and this is like a major, it's like every year it seems like there's a new, like, you know, major catastrophe to weather. And, you know, after a while, you know, it's hard to swim to the surface of the water when it keeps washing over you, you know? We just keep plugging away.
Well, thankfully, we definitely know we're getting three more books, at least, from Greg over the next few years. So, Greg, thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything else, man, that we should touch on that we didn't talk about?
I just want to give a little shout out to my first middle grade book, the one that came out last year, Kid vs. Squid, which is sort of a contemporary middle, it's middle grade, it's a contemporary fantasy about a kid who goes on summer vacation and has to fight the witch that sunk the lost continent of Atlantis. It's a funny book, and so if anybody picks up Boy at the End of the World and likes it, maybe they'll want to pick up Kid versus Squid.
And if anyone listening knows Greg, they you know he's a funny guy, so he can do humor.
I can try.
All right, of course, we'll put all the links for all three of your titles in the show notes. So folks, come to the show notes, click on them, and buy Greg's books.
Please.
All right, buddy. Thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, thanks, Sean. That was fun.
Genre television themes of all time. Tuning into scifitv.com.
Moses, a few days ago, your book launched, as we talked about earlier and in the last episode. So give us a little update, man. How's it been going?
It's kind of, I'm hesitant to say it, but so far it's like, you know, you dream about how you want your book to launch. And so far that's kind of been happening. I mean, I had a couple reviews I was waiting on from some book reviewers who review indie books who are, you know, trusted, and they've written some pretty wonderful reviews. Motherload is one of them. She rarely gives out 5-star reviews, and she gave out a very enthusiastic 5-star review, which we have a link to that in the show notes for the previous episode, number 130. So that you know, that I was high after that, and I got another couple today. I got a couple, one I wasn't expecting. And one guy who runs a website called Indie Fantasy Review, and he edits and writes. He actually said that this, you know, my book was to date the finest example of quality indie fantasy he has seen.
Wow!
So that was pretty high praise. You know? And I was like, wow, really? And then the other thing I wanted was just to get some sales, and I've had more sales than I thought I would get. I mean, I've been in the top 2,500 in the Kindle store. Today I made it into that, which is pretty good territory. I've been in the top 100 in Epic Fantasy each day the last 3 days, and I'm actually able to look at it and go like, wow, I'm actually 100-er now. You know, if my friend asked me if I was a millionaire yet, and I looked at it and been like, well, I'm a 200-er. Well, that's pretty cool, you know. So I'm sure my wife likes that part. But yeah, it's just actually, you know, just really, I mean, it's actually my birthday tomorrow. And so this is just all kinds of cool stuff coming together. You know, I decided to release it around my birthday, kind of, it would be more fun. And it's kind of, you know, just knock on wood, a little momentary dream come true. And I would really like to thank everyone who listens to our podcast, who maybe heard our last episode and, you know, has thought about buying my book, or who bought my book, or who's just listening and who's just getting a kick out of it, because that's just beautiful. And I'm glad, you know, you guys are here kind of witnessing the journey too.
Well, and you would have one more if Barnes & Noble would get their act together.
Yeah, we're waiting for Barnes & Noble to put the book up, but it could be any second now, you know. So that one should be up any minute now. It's up at Kindle. It's up at Smashwords. I'm going to get it up at iBooks. And I'm just finalizing the print version, so that should be up in a week or two. Okay. So we'll see what happens next. You know, I don't know if it'll fall back and you know, just, you know, not see much, or if it'll get on a roll and go. So it's going to be fun to see what happens, hopefully.
Oh, Brent, did you not care what Moses had to say, or what?
No, I think my connection got dropped there.
You did. You got dropped, but you're back, so that's okay.
I got back. No, I was actually very interested in what Moses had to say. I guess I'm going to have to listen to the show now.
It's like Moses. Moses starts talking and bloop, Brent is gone.
Yeah, I'm so done with this. Click.
So, well, if you folks, if you want to buy Moses' book, and I highly suggest you do, we've made it easy for you. Moses has made it easy for you. Show notes, episode 130. As new links are available, they will be added. So that can always be a resource for you to go to, so you can hop straight to the Black Gods War on whatever different site or platform you're looking for it in. So make sure you're keeping your eyes on that. Well, Brent, you will have to listen to the show to catch up on that. But why don't you go ahead and move us forward on what's next here?
Yeah, not a problem. We've got some new things going on with social media. We have two new Twitter lists you can follow, three altogether. We have one for writers and editors, and now one for podcasts and magazine and publishers. Please subscribe to them if you like. You know, Twitter lists are nice to follow, particularly if you're using like a third-party kind of Twitter aggregator. They're really easy and nice to follow. And we've also, just as a reminder, we'll be participating in SFF. So it's Sci-Fi Writer Chat, SFF, WRTCHT, in September with Brian Thomas Schmidt on Twitter. You can join us as well all September to talk with guests you hear on this show, including Greg Van Eekhout, who'll be on September 7th, Daniel Polansky, who's on September 14th, our own Moses Sirigar, the 3rd, September 21st.
And the third.
He'll be bringing his hot red keyboard. Bam! And then September 28th, you'll have the ASFP podcast with Mr. Sean Farrell. And I'm glad I have the dates now. Now I can get on and hate you guys both.
Oh, you can hate us publicly like you do privately?
No, not hate you. I said haze you.
Oh, haze. Same thing.
Heckle. How about heckle? How about I'll heckle you?
Okay, that's better.
All right. That'd be awesome.
Now, yeah. These chats, they're at 7 p.m. Pacific, right? I want to say.
I can't confirm that right now.
Okay, I'm pretty sure they're at 7 p.m. Pacific. We'll confirm that later on. But subscribe, no, not subscribe, follow Brian. Well, he has a personal page, and you can follow at SFFWRTCHT. And we have the link in the show notes. I need to post an article about this, too. But it'd be fun to have you guys there to ask questions to the authors who are here. You know, then you can go ask them your own questions on Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah, it's very cool to participate in one of these chats. And go ahead and participate before September so you can get the feel of it. You know, I would encourage people to even just to listen and watch one of the chats before diving in.
All right, let's wrap this one up, put it to bed. Again, join us on Facebook and Twitter. Links on the homepage if you don't know where we are. And again, you can enter the Clark's World giveaway. We have two great prizes up for grabs. These are international contests. Details are on the homepage on the Clark's World giveaway article. And you still have a few weeks to get your entry in, but that time will fly by, so don't wait too long. Give us a call on the voicemail line, 619-75-AISFP. We still haven't got any voicemail, which is, I guess that's why the other voicemail expired, because it wasn't getting used. So sad. Sam used to get voicemail all the time, but whatever. I know we still need to pick a winner for the Dervish House giveaway from the people who donated to us, and I ran out of time today because I was getting my brakes replaced and it took 2 hours longer than it was supposed to. So we'll do that in the next show. And if everyone who did donate in June and July, thank you very much for your support. We appreciate it a great deal.
And Sean, are you going to be at Worldcon?
I'm going to be there on Friday and Saturday.
Cool. I'm still last minute. I'm still not sure if I'm going or not.
If you have a place that Moses can crash.
No, I have some friends. Some friends said that I could sleep in their hotel room. So I have a place.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, as long as you're not like the Airbnb scam, part of the Airbnb scandal, Moses, where the person rented a room and then trashed it, vandalized it.
I know, I'm pretty boring, so.
Okay. Moses Sirigar and the third.
I might actually drink like a half a beer while I'm there or something, you know.
Okay. You could live with us if that's all you require is half a beer.
Yeah, that's like me having a wild night out.
I'll take the other half for you. We are a Parsec finalist. We're on the final ballot, so that's awesome. They'll be giving those awards away at Dragon Con. And Moses, you have all the information on that. Tell us what, where we are on that.
Yeah, I'll actually be there. So if we win, I'll be sure to give a really long acceptance speech.
Yes.
we've been nominated for the best podcast about speculative fiction content creation. It's either about podcasts that are about the creative process and or about the technical aspects of speculative fiction podcast creation. It's kind of like two very different things. But we're in there with I Should Be Writing, Full Cast Podcast, Get Published, and Podcast Teardown. So there's five nominees. We're one of them. And we'll see if I get to fly home from Atlanta with some hardware.
Well, I use an Alesis 8-channel mixer, an MXL990 condenser microphone, a pre-USB preamp to power the microphone, an iRevert. Okay, wait a minute. Never mind.
nicely done, Sean.
Now I got both categories covered, so there you go. Yeah, no, it's great to be nominated, and there are a ton of shows on the final ballot, so that tells you how many shows were nominated. And yes, make sure, I'll email them, so if we do win, they'll introduce you as Moses Sirigar and the Thirds.
I always thought my band would be the Commandments, you know, but...
I don't know. I like the Thirds.
That's cool. No, I like it. The Roman numerals, maybe?
You can only have four people in your band. That's why. So
Moses, well, he could... If you wanted to play on a variation of the Thirds and still have a writing reference, he could name his band Committing Trilogy.
Ooh.
That's pretty good.
I was thinking something trilogy related.
Committing Trilogy. Those were some of the best. Moses, did you see those at World Fantasy last year? They had the little ribbons that they were handing out to put on your badges. I kept one. I loved it so much.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, they were called Committing Trilogy. I'm Committing Trilogy.
That's cool.
That's a good name for a band. I like it.
I do too.
But not as good as... Okay, I won't do it again. And finally, if you don't listen to SF Signal, and you should because we've been talking about them for the last 2 months, I was on episode 66, a conversation about science fiction conventions. So come check it out if you'd like. And I was supposed to be on episode 70, but I got hung up at work and couldn't get back in time. And that episode is about podcasts. So even though I wasn't there, they still talked about us a little bit. So check that out. Something cool to listen to. Well, guys, I think that's about it. Am I missing anything?
I think we covered it.
All right, then. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more. And email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at MusicAlley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.
And now, Moses Sirigar and the Thirds.